You're listening to a talk given by Al Stewart at the City Bible Forum, Brisbane.
Well, nice to be here again. It's lunchtime. Now, a while ago, I was watching television in the middle of the day. I can't remember why, but I thought it was a really good reason. And I ended up watching Oprah Winfrey. Now, Oprah was interviewing Arnold Schwarzenegger. So we got that picture there, Glenn? Okay. Now, there's the big guy. This is just before Arnold was the governor. And she was fawning all over him about how rich and famous he is and so on. And Arnie says to her, at the end of talking about how much money he'd made and so on, he says to her, "Oprah, I have to tell you, I have found that money doesn't bring happiness. I now have $50 million, and I'm no happier than when I had $48 million. And he has a little smile and so on, like, "Yep, you've nailed it." Because what he's saying is he's mocking the idea that we say money doesn't bring happiness. But you know what? I don't think anyone really believes that. Even as I say it, money doesn't bring happiness. In the back of my head, there's a little voice saying, "Yeah, but I'd like a truckload to find out for myself." Yeah, and it's the same for you too. My guess is. Why? Money is very seductive. Money offers us or promises us the two things, I think, that drive our lives, which is the desire to feel important, to feel like we matter, and the desire to be safe. Security and significance. I think, you know, for some of us it's more the idea of I want to feel significant. For some of us it might be more the idea of I want to feel safe and secure. But money promises or offers both of those things. And money is, how can I put it, money is sexy. Right? It's seductive. Now, I don't know how often you see this, but the BRW Business Review Weekly Rich 200 list. And they put that out every year. This is a 2009 edition because I was too tight to buy the 2010, 11 and 12 edition. But
Are you in there?
No, unfortunately no. What do they do? Well, it ranges here from Gina Reinhart wasn't on the top of the list. She would be now. In 2009 she was about 4th or 5th, I think. And the amounts of money range from $4.5 billion to a pathetic, really, $150 million. But it sells, and they keep doing it again and again. Why? Because money's sexy and exciting. They don't put out one called The Poor 2 Million. Anyway. Okay. And, you know, money's very personal. As you talk about money with people, it's a very personal thing. I've worked as a pastor of a church for many years, and I, you know, talk to blokes one-to-one about things, very personal things. And you know what? It's much easier to talk about a man's marriage, or sex life, or his children, or his job. But it's a very personal thing to ask someone how much money they make. It's funny. What's your salary is much more personal than how's your sex life. It's just money's us. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, as he writes, talks about the idea of money and its power and so on, but does it really deliver on those promises? Does it really give us something at last, something that's concrete? Let me show you. Some of us were here yesterday, some of us not. As the book of Ecclesiastes, written about 900 BC, probably, or that's when Solomon lived, either written by Solomon himself or, if you like, through the eyes of Solomon. And here's the question that he's asking in this book that's part of the Old Testament. Here's the opening statement that's about how he sees the world. "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher, "utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless." As I said yesterday, forgive me for repeating, just in case you weren't here, that the word "meaningless," the English translations have a bit of trouble finding a word that captures the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word is hevel, which means a breath or a mist or a vapour, something that's there and then it's gone. He's saying the world is like that. Everything feels like that. Nothing lasts. Nothing's substantial. It just kind of all seems to fade away. And then he goes looking for something that is kind of substantial, if you like. What is it that really has meaning, purpose? What is it that really lasts? And the way he frames the question, chapter 1, verse 3, is this. "What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun?" So the word "gain" is a commercial term. What's the bottom line? What's the cash value? What have we got left that really lasts, given all of our hard work, our labour, under the sun? And that little phrase, "under the sun," it's really kind of a loaded thing. It's 27 times it comes up in the book. I think he means, as you just look out at the world, how do you make sense of it? And what you see people do. Now, this is almost 3,000 years ago that he wrote this, and yet what amazes me about this book is it speaks like today's newspaper to our world. Okay, so what are you going under the sun? And what he sets out to do is to find something that really lasts. Something, what is it that's not hevel? What is it that's not a vapor or a mist? Now, we saw yesterday in chapter 1 where he looks at the endless cycles of our world. The world just goes on and on and on and on and on, and we're only here for 5 minutes and we get bored while we are. Okay. And then he sets out on a quest to find what will give life meaning and purpose. What is it that really lasts? In the beginning of chapter 2, he looks at the idea of pleasure. He said, well, if you're a hedonist, is that the way that you find it? And now, Glenn, there's the opportunity to read the book of Ecclesiastes as a group, isn't it, coming up? Okay. So if you read it, I won't go into it too much. The beginning of chapter 2, what he says is, well, I pursued pleasure. And in the end, he decides, look, pleasure is a good thing. He's not against the idea of pleasure. But pleasure's a bit like splashing your face with water. It feels good, but the water always slips through your hands. Pleasure's nice, but you can never quite hold on to it. It doesn't last. It's a breath. Or success, or building beautiful things, or kind of aesthetics, or so on. It's nice, but it just kind of slips through your fingers. And then in chapter 2, what I wanted to look at with you today, he looks at the idea of work and wealth and possessions. In fact, he does in chapter 2, where he talks about the idea of our work and how we feel about that. And then again in chapter 5, where he talks about the idea of possessions. So on your outline, on your program, you've got a quote from chapter 2 and a quote from chapter 5. Okay, so I thought what we'd do is, I just want to walk you through his arguments, or what it is that he found, as Solomon, who is an incredibly wealthy man, one of the richest men in the ancient world, could have anything he wanted. What is it that he found about money, possessions and so on? Now here's, I've got, 20 minutes left. And basically, I want to ask you, if I take you through Solomon's reasons, I'm going to ask you at the end whether you're convinced. Or whether actually there's a little voice in the back of the head saying, I'd like a truckload to find out for myself. Because what he does is he gives us 9 reasons, across chapter 2 and chapter 5, 9 reasons why he's saying the wealth and possessions and everything never quite delivers on what it promises. Never quite delivers significance and security and so on. Okay, let's have a look. See verse 18. Chapter 2, verse 18. The first of his 9 reasons. He says, I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun. Why? What's his first reason? Answer, verse 18. Because I must leave them to someone who comes after me. That's true, isn't it? There's no pockets in shrouds. He's going to leave it all behind and someone else gets all of that money. So you work really hard, you're paying off your mortgage for 25, 30 years, you know what's going to happen is you'll leave it behind and someone else will have it. In fact, if you look at verse 19, it's worse than that. He's saying, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, and yet he'll have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. I wonder if Solomon wrote that as he sat and kind of looked out of his palace. Maybe his son Rehoboam was, sitting outside or he could see Rehoboam, his son. I don't know if you've ever read the Old Testament account of Solomon, but Solomon set up this magnificent empire, administratively complex, trading all over the world and so on, the absolute height of ancient Israel. And then his son Rehoboam basically destroyed the empire, tore it apart, set the seeds for civil war, lost 10 out of the 12 tribes of Israel and so on. Does anyone know how long it took him to achieve that?
5 years.
It was 3 days. You think, how could he achieved it in 3 days? You might like to read, it's in the book of 1 Kings. Who knows whether to be a wise man or a fool? Maybe Solomon looked out, saw his son and thought, right, I know. So, you've got to leave it to someone else and they may well be an idiot. Well, the second reason, verse 20. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labour under the sun. For a person, may do his work with wisdom, knowledge and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. They not only have to leave it to someone else, by definition, for an inheritance, they haven't worked for it. They're going to leave it to someone who hasn't worked for it. Now, I wonder whether the baby boomers are beginning to work that out, and so more and more of them are working on skinning their kids. You know that, S-K-I-N, skin your kids? Spend kids' inheritance now. So, Kathy and I went to the Kimberleys a couple of years ago on a holiday, and you can't get a parking spot up there. There's all the grey nomads with their expensive four-wheel drives and the giant caravans and the satellite dishes and the skinning their kids. Okay, so you leave it to the kids who haven't worked for it. Third reason, verse 22. What does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labours under the sun? All his days his work is pain and grief. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. I think what he's saying is, if we invest everything we've got in making money and climbing the ladder and that becomes the most important thing in our life, he's saying you can't leave it behind, and even at night his mind doesn't, it can be hard to sleep. So you can end up working all day and then not being able to sleep at night. And I don't know if that ever troubles you, but it does trouble me sometimes. So I can go to sleep all right, no trouble, but sometimes I'll wake up at 3 a.m. and think, okay, that's it, what am I going to do for the next... okay, all right. Now, Solomon's not a misery guts. Well, he's not saying, I want you to be miserable. He's saying, let's have a think about life. You see what he says in verse 24? What's the best you can do? He says, verse 24, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat and find enjoyment? So eat and drink and enjoy your work is a gift of God. If you're fortunate enough to be actually in a job that you enjoy, thank God for that. That's the gift of God. Most people on planet Earth haven't had that luxury over the centuries. Now, verse 26, it's a little bit hard to work out exactly, and I've got to fess up. I'm not exactly sure what he means in verse 26. So, to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, the idea of a vapor, something that doesn't last, meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Now, the word there that they've translated sinner, it just means someone who's offensive. And so when you go to the scholars and the experts, they're divided. Does it mean it's like someone who does the righteous, someone who does the right thing, gets knowledge and happiness, but the sinner, the one who does the wrong thing, just gathers up their wealth and ends up having to give it to someone else? Well, if that's the reason, why is it meaningless? You know, someone who does the wrong thing misses out. Or is he saying the ways of God seem arbitrary? Some people get wealth and are able to enjoy it. Other people have wealth and don't seem to be able to enjoy it and end up just holding it till they give it on to someone else. And who can work it out? So quick summary, chapter 2. You're going to leave it all to someone else who may well be an idiot. You'll leave it to someone who hasn't worked for it, and you can get so caught up in it, you can never actually rest and relax. All right. Now, have a look at chapter 5. It comes back to that idea. More on the idea of possessions and so on. Have a look at chapter 5, verse 10. He says, whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. You might want to think, what do the following men have in common? So, Alan Bond, Christopher Skase, Nick Leeson, who worked for Barings Bank, Bernie Ebbers, WorldCom, Ray Williams, HIH, Renee Rivkin, and Bernie Madoff, who made it onto that list a little more recently. What do they have in common? Yeah, they were men who had done well, were what we call financially successful. They were, many of them you call rich, but it just wasn't quite enough. And just one circumstance after another, and then they can't pull up. So I read about Bernie Madoff. Was it $50 or $60 billion involved in the fraud? And his investment thing went bad for a year, and he wasn't prepared to acknowledge that it had gone bad, and so he did this little fraud with the Ponzi thing to cover that up, and then the next year it was more, and then bigger and bigger and bigger, and he couldn't... Were they... particularly evil men? I don't know. Probably not. They just got caught up in the momentum of it all. What's he say? See verse 10, whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. Now, okay, I'm guilty, right? I'm guilty that there just never seemed to be quite enough money, and why? Even in our society, isn't it, that there never seems to be quite enough money to build the roads we need, or have the hospital facilities we need, or personally, we always seem to be up to here with... If we had, just let's say, if we tripled our income, that'd have to be enough, wouldn't it? Yeah? Just somebody nod to show that. Yeah? No? Okay. Do you know, it's in Clive Hamilton's book, Affluenza. Do you know that in real terms, we are three times wealthier than in the 1950s? Real terms. And when you do the stats and go back, we have seven times the income of 100 years ago. Between 1900 and the year 2000, real income, allowing for inflation, real income jumped sevenfold. You gotta think, seven times, why is it that's not quite enough? Lots of possible reasons. You just kind of, human nature is, isn't it, we look forward to something and we think, when we just get whatever it is, then I'll be content. Like 18 months ago, I was getting to the point of needing another car, and I was looking forward, scheming, dreaming about getting a new Commodore, and managed to get it in January last year, and it was great. For about a week, I reckon, it was really exciting, and then it's just kind of baldy-headed me driving around in this again, and yeah. And you'll probably find things like that with a car or clothes or golf clubs or a house or whatever. And the other thing is, yesterday's luxuries become today's necessities. When I grew up, here's one of those things that, you know, your kids just love it when you tell them these stories, right? They glaze over just to leave the room. When I grew up, we had two dishwashers in our house. Me and my brother. And then, because Dad told us to do the dishes. Now, everybody has a machine dishwasher. And you know what? It's invisible. I remember in 1975, we got our first colour television. That was a big deal. Now, colour televisions are invisible. In fact, now you've got to have a gigantic plasma screen, and they're invisible. And today's luxuries... yesterday's luxuries become today's necessities, become invisible, and then what's the next thing? It's just human nature, and that's why it's never quite enough. Or his fifth reason, see chapter 5, verse 11. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? So the more money you get, the more hangers-on there are. And the more stuff you get, what can you do but look at it? I remember my brother talking to my dad about a while ago about my brother mixing his business partner. And Mark said to my dad, oh yeah, and Dad, his partner, he bought this house on the lower north shore of Sydney. It's a big house. And what he did, he's a builder, he took the roof off it and he built the whole first floor where all the bedrooms are now. And downstairs is just a massive entertaining area. And it's like this huge lounge room. And we walked into the lounge room, my dad's home, we walked into the lounge room and we counted 14 lounge chairs. 14 lounge chairs. And my dad said, yeah, 14 lounge chairs. But he's only got one bum. We're all only got one bum. We can all only sleep in one bed. We can all only eat one meal at a time. And what do you do but look at things? Sixth reason, the sleep of a labourer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. It's hard to know. Does he mean that, you know, you're a labourer, you sleep well? Does he mean a rich man, rich woman lies awake at night worrying about their assets and share portfolio, or does it mean that the rich people got to eat too much and so couldn't sleep well? Hard to know. All right. One last thing, verse 5, verse 13. I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there is nothing left for him. Isn't it? It's a bit sad at the moment, isn't it, that some of our wealthiest, or one of our wealthiest families, is having this huge public brawl about money. And you kind of think, wouldn't there be enough money that just falls down the back of the couch? right? For everyone to have enough, but anyway. All those reasons may not get much traction with you. Number seven is his strongest reason. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labour that he can carry in his hand. This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain, since he toils for the wind? In the Rich 200 magazine, at the back, as I said, the amounts vary from 4.5 billion to 150 billion in this magazine. In the back, they have departures, people who are no longer on the rich list. Sometimes it's they've had a financial catastrophe and they've dropped off, but often it's that that they've died. And so they have a brief obituary here. There was one man from Melbourne who was a manufacturer, another man from South Australia, transport magnate and so on. They have a brief obituary, and then at the end they list how much they left behind. And what surprised me when I looked at it, 4.5 million to 150, but when you get to the how much they left behind, it was always the same amount. Everything. Everything. See what he says, verse 16? This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain, since he toils for the wind? We're born empty-handed, we die empty-handed. When I left home, my entire worldly possessions, I left home at 18 to go down to Sydney, my entire worldly possessions consisted of two suitcases and a cardboard box. The last time we moved house, it took, I think it was two Pantechnicons to move us, like with after four kids and all the stuff we'd accumulated. But I was just thinking, it won't be too long and I'll make a move and I won't need the two suitcases, it'll be just a box is all I'll need. And I think if we get tied up with thinking that life's about how much we own, and it's so easy to do that, it's so seductive, that it can just tie us in knots, the thought of having to leave it behind and so on. That's what he's saying in verse 17. As all his days he eats in darkness. This is the one that you can't let go. All his days he eats in darkness with great frustration, affliction and anger. I think you get caught up in wanting more and more and more, it just becomes a miserable business. Now, they're all negative. Let me give you a positive one. The eighth reason. He talks about an alternative. See, there's an alternative to wanting to own the world. See chapter 5, verse 18? He says this. Then I realised that it is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given him, for this is his lot. Moreover, when God gives any man, person, wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. He seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. If you can enjoy life and your work and labour, it's a gift of God. Enjoy things rather than, if you like, enjoy the world rather than having to own the world and be thankful to God. It's a little bit hard to know. See in the middle of verse 20, it says he seldom reflects on the days of his life. Literally the word is he seldom remembers the days of his life. A little bit hard to know exactly what he means, but I wonder if he's saying when life's good and you roll along and you're content, it's easy for the days to slip by. You tend to remember the crises and hard times in life rather than the good times. I think that might be what he means. And so the question is, there's eight reasons. Do we believe it? Do we believe it? Like I say, money, it's so seductive. It's the air that our world breathes, especially in a big city, that money offers security and significance. And Solomon's saying, no, it doesn't ever quite deliver. Tell you something that's strange, and most people wouldn't realise. When you come to Jesus and his teaching in the New Testament, Jesus teaches much more about money than about sex. Now, he teaches about sex occasionally and so on, but he teaches about money all the time. Why? Because I think money is more seductive than sex. I like to think about whether you agree with that or not. And what Jesus keeps saying to us is, have your eyes open and see and understand that money and possessions and our attitude to it is so often our great blind spot. And he warns us again and again about that. Let me just show you one question that he asked for us. In Mark chapter 8, he asks this. What good is it for a man, what good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? What he means is you can spend your whole life accumulating more and more and more and more stuff and have ignored God and be without God for eternity. It's actually kind of lose your soul. He's saying it's a bad deal. He said there were nine reasons. Here's the ninth one. Not quite from Solomon. I've fudged this a little bit, forgive me. But here's the ninth reason. Does anyone know who those nine people are? Yeah, that's right. Just go back. Wait, 1 second. Can you go back? Yeah. There's Renee Lawrence, Scott Rush have probably got the most publicity. Yeah, they're the Bali Nine. And here's something surprising. I checked it this morning. They were arrested in 2005. So those poor kids, well, poor kids, those young people, 7 years that's dragged on for. What was interesting, now that's Renee Lawrence. What was interesting, in the paper, I saved a newspaper clipping from around that time. The lawyer who was appointed said, I'll say kids because they're the same age as my kids, these young adults, these kids, half of them didn't realise that Indonesia had the death penalty for drug carrying. And they were only going to make $15,000 from doing this. And the lawyer said, imagine losing your life for just $15,000. And that's a really bad deal, isn't it? But I thought, what would be a good deal? Imagine losing your life for, put a number on it. And that's what Jesus is saying. Even the whole world that costs you your soul, your relationship with God, it's a bad deal. And so, as Ecclesiastes always does, I want to ask you today, what is it in life that truly lasts and truly delivers?